It seems to me that people are generally born with a sense of a desire for justice. You don't need to teach kids to say, that's not fair. Though, I've got to clarify this, isn't it? I don't think people are born with a sense of doing justice to others, or even a sense of wanting justice for others, but we've got this instinct when we're wronged that we want to see justice done for us. Like when there's that person who's been tailgating you down the freeway, and when you finally have space to safely pull to the side, they floor it and fly away. What do? You start dreaming that in a few kilometres down the road, you're going to see them pulled over by the police, or even better, stuck on the side of the road with a flat tyre. We want them to face justice. But the problem is that justice is rarely swift or sweet. The news is full of terrible stories, and we're hardened. We don't expect to see justice done. Whether it's corrupt politicians or organised crime, look, what's the odds of them ever facing justice? But the problem isn't just out there, it's a personal problem. When someone at work or uni claims your work as theirs, it's unfair, but what can you do about it? You don't expect justice to be done, you just suck it up. When Nathan showed up at church with a black eye the other week and you heard his story, does anyone actually expect that the police are going to find and charge the guy who did it? And being a Christian can make these problems, the problem of injustice, even harder. Because we don't just have this vague hope in the laws of nature or justice somehow in the universe. We don't just hope that what goes around will come around. No, our hope is in a personal God, the God who is defined by justice. Psalm 50 says about God, the heavens proclaim his righteousness, for he is a God of justice. In this psalm, righteousness and justice are synonymous. God is a God of justice. So where is God when we don't see justice? How can we keep trusting in God when we don't see sweet and swift justice? Well, last week we left Esther, Mordecai and the Jews at a cliffhanger. The story of Esther started with King Xerxes throwing this obscene party and requesting his queen to come and parade herself in front of the men of Susa. Queen Vashti refused and was banned from ever being in the king's presence again. This led to Xerxes running a despicable beauty pageant, Miss Persian World, 483 BC, and that's the context where we meet Esther. Esther is an orphaned Jew who ends up winning the competition and becoming queen to this rash, foolish, pompous, pagan king. After this, after Esther wins the competition, her cousin Mordecai has got himself and the entire Jewish race into trouble. He's gotten them into trouble because he's offended Haman, who is the king's 2IC. Haman has a massive ego, and he requires that everyone who sees him has to bow down in honour before him. But Mordecai refuses to bow, and when Haman finds out about this and then finds out that Mordecai is a Jew, he gets a law passed in order to totally annihilate the Jewish race. This is not a vain threat. Haman has the power to do it, and so Mordecai challenges Esther to present herself before the king. Even though she may die for doing this without being invited by the king, and Mordecai challenges her to do this because he reasons, well, it may well be for this very moment to rescue the Jewish people from genocide. This might be the reason why Esther has found herself to be queen. And so as we finished up last week, we finished up with Esther asking the Jewish people to fast and, I assume, pray, to fast and pray for 3 days. And Esther committed that at the end of those 3 days, she would go to the king, and if she perishes, she perishes. Well, where we picked up the story today in chapter 5, it's 3 days later, the end of those 3 days of fasting and, I assume, praying, Esther approaches the throne room. And Xerxes sees her coming. And fortunately for us, Xerxes is happy to see her. Probably more fortunate for Esther when you think about it. We're just reading the story. And as we've seen him do over and over again, he makes a rash decision, a rash promise to Esther. He's going to do anything that Esther wants. He'll even give her half of his kingdom, half of the Persian Empire, half of the world can be hers if that's what she wants. Now, it's probably not a literal offer, but you get the point. Anything she dreams of can be hers. I bet you that Esther is pretty glad that she's caught Xerxes on a good day. Well, Esther makes her request. She asks Xerxes to come to a private party that she's prepared, just herself and Xerxes and Haman. Now, we might read this and we think, look, what's Esther doing? Why doesn't she just play her hand straight up? The king seems to be in a good mood. Surely the request, hey, King Xerxes, can you stop a genocide from occurring? Surely that's not too much to ask. But we need to remember that when Xerxes agreed to Haman's plan and the plan became law, when that happened, well, the context for something becoming law, back in chapter 1, we heard that the laws that the king makes can't be repealed. For Esther to ask the king to go back on his word may well have been close to impossible, or at least would have caused him shame to lose face in front of the rest of the powerful people in Persia. And also, a few of the commentaries that I've looked at suggest that this is actually the normal way that things were done in ancient Near Eastern palaces. A queen wouldn't go up and just ask her king for something in public. It's not how you do things. If you want something done and you're the queen, you need to ask to meet in private with the king. So Esther is showing her wisdom here. She's following protocol. And also, there's no rush for her. There's no rush for them to change, to deal with the situation. They've got about 11 months lead time before the appointed day, the day that the dice were rolled to appoint the day when the genocide would occur. And she's also showing wisdom, not just patience, but wisdom when she invites Haman to come along, because she needs to be able to watch and anticipate not only what the king is going to do, but also what his 2IC is going to do. And well, Xerxes is found in a good mood, and we know that he loves a good party, and so he thinks, look, this is a great idea, another party to go to, and he fetches for Haman, and they go to Esther's banquet that she's already got ready for him. I suppose it was either going to be a banquet or the death penalty for her, so what's the risk of being prepared? And when they get there, Xerxes knows that there's an agenda for this party. He's not just being invited for a good time, and so he brings up the topic again. What do you want, Esther? Anything up to half of my kingdom. But Esther keeps her cards close to her chest and asks only that the king and Haman join her for another banquet tomorrow. Well, Haman is stoked by this. It puffs up his already inflated ego. The beautiful Queen Esther wants him not just at one, but at two of her private parties. And so he goes home, his head's in the clouds, but on his way home he comes crashing down to earth. As he leaves the palace, people are bowing to him left, right, and center. He's been invited to a party, he's feeling good, except there's Mordecai. And this brings Haman crashing down to earth. How petty of Haman. Surely with everything else going so well for him, he shouldn't even notice this little thing. Mordecai just shouldn't even be in his eyesight. He should just be. But he does. And when he gets home, he is furious. He boasts about being honored by the king and by the queen, but then he just whinges about Mordecai. So we're going to pick it up in Esther chapter 5 and verse 9. Esther chapter 5, verse 9. Haman, boo, Haman. Haman went out that day happy and in high spirits. But when he saw Mordecai at the king's gate and observed that he neither rose nor showed fear in his presence, he was filled with rage against Mordecai. Nevertheless, Haman restrained himself and went home. Calling together his friends and Zeresh, his wife, Haman boasted to them about his vast wealth, his many sons, and all the ways the king had honored him, and how he had elevated him above the other nobles and officials. And that's not all, Haman added. I am the only person Queen Esther invited to accompany the king to the banquet she gave, and she has invited me along with the king tomorrow. But all this gives me no satisfaction as long as I see that Jew Mordecai sitting at the king's gate. Well, Haman has a sympathetic wife and friends. Instead of telling him just to get over himself, as I would have done, or even just saying, look, genocide's coming, mate. Just wait till the day of genocide. Come on, you can wait a couple of months. They give him this great idea. Hey, why don't you go and get Mordecai executed tomorrow morning so that you can go to Esther's party and be in a good mood? Verse 14, his wife Zeresh and his friends said to him, have a pole set up reaching up a height of 50 cubits. That's 23 meters or 5 stories tall. This is a massive device he's setting up, and ask the king in the morning to have Mordecai impaled on it. Then go with the king to the banquet and enjoy yourself. This suggestion delighted Haman, and he had the pole set up. Oh dear, this is not good news for our heroes, Esther and Mordecai. It looked like Esther was being quite wise in biding her time and getting everything set up before making her request, but here's this new threat that's come in out of left field. Well, it just so happens that whilst Haman got things together, daydreaming about the end of Mordecai, the body impaled, the king can't sleep. And so Xerxes tries counting sheep. That doesn't work. And so he gets some people to read out his own personal history to him. Can you imagine one night John Howard can't sleep? So what's he do? He goes to his shelf. He pulls out Lazarus Rising, his own personal autobiography, because he's just so vain. Or Julia Gillard reading My Story because it's boring enough to put her to sleep. That's Xerxes for you. He's either super vain or thinks his own story is boring enough to put him to sleep. Anyway, it just happens that as they're reading to him, it's interesting, he doesn't read to himself, he gets other people to read to him anyway. He's lazy and vain. What comes up but the events that we just read, that we read about last week in chapter 2, when Mordecai just happened to overhear an assassination plan. This event is read to Xerxes, and he realizes, oh, look, I've never got around to rewarding Mordecai, and so he decides in the middle of the night that he needs to fix that. And at just that moment, Haman is coming to see the king about getting this Mordecai executed. Talk about timing. And so Xerxes finds out Haman's coming in, calls in Haman, says, hey, before Haman gets a chance to get a word, and he says, hey, what reward should he give? So chapter 6, verse 4, let's pick it up. Esther 6, verse 4. The king said, who is in the court? Now Haman had just entered the outer court of the palace to speak to the king about impaling Mordecai on the pole he had set up for him. His attendants answered, Haman is standing in the court. Bring him in, the king ordered. When Haman entered, the king asked him, what should be done for the man the king delights to honor? Now Haman thought to himself, who is there that the king would rather honor than me? His ego is out again. And so he answered the king, for the man the king delights to honor, have them bring a royal robe the king has worn and a horse the king has ridden, one with a royal crest placed on its head. Then let the robe and horse be entrusted to one of the king's most noble princes. Let them robe the man the king delights to honor and lead him on the horse through the city streets, proclaiming before him, this is what is done for the man the king delights to honor. Go at once, the king commanded Haman. Get the robe and the horse and do just as you have suggested for Mordecai, the Jew who sits at the king's gate. Do not neglect anything you have recommended. So Haman got the robe and the horse. He robed Mordecai and led him on horseback through the city streets, proclaiming before him, this is what is done for the man the king delights to honor. Ouch. This must have made Haman's head spin. He must have been burning inside. This is not how tonight is meant to go. Mordecai has just been awarded Persian of the Year. There is obviously no way that he can now get Mordecai killed. What a coincidence. Esther is full of these coincidences. Esther becomes queen. Mordecai overhearing the assassination plans. The king reading of Mordecai's loyalty and Haman walking in at just that moment. There's more in there too, but they're not coincidences, are they? Esther is this funny book where God isn't mentioned. If he's here at all, he's in the shadows. He's in the coincidences. The way the story is put together, I reckon we're meant to see that there's absolutely no way that all of these coincidences could just happen. They're not coincidences. They're not fate. They're not luck. They're providence. They're God working in the shadows to deliver his people. One of the sad things about myself, and I reckon many of us here, is that even though we are reformed Christians, remember we talked about that at the beginning of last year, God's sovereignty is one of the truths that we hold dear and emphasize in our theology. What we believe strongly about God is that he is in control of everything, yet we're like the book of Esther. We're reluctant to name God. We're reluctant to say that God is behind things. We're reluctant to honor his providence, his providential control over everything. Now, there is reasons for this. You can say too much. You hear Christians saying that not only was God behind certain events, but they also know the reason why God did something. Like the reason why you missed the bus to uni last week was so that you would pause and reflect and think, oh, look, uni's not right for you. That's obvious, isn't it? That's why God providentially did this thing. Now, that could be why. Or it might be that God wanted to teach you to be more organized and more responsible. And that shameful experience of walking into the lecture half an hour late was to teach you, right, you've got to get organized. Or it might be to teach you, you've got to get fit and start riding a bike instead of trusting on the bus timetables. Maybe that's why we don't speak of God working in circumstances and coincidences, because we don't know necessarily why things are occurring. But I wonder if it's more that practically we're atheists. We don't really believe that God is involved in our world. But one of the things that Esther does by not mentioning God, ironically it does this, is that it hits us even harder how obvious it is that God is behind all this. He's in control of what people say and hear. He keeps kings up at night and causes the dice to fall on a certain day. I reckon one of the things we need to learn from Esther is to relearn the vocabulary of God doing stuff, of God's providence. Not that we would claim to know the mind of God, but that we can acknowledge God's hand behind everything. But back to where we were in the story of Esther, that was a bit of an aside. After Haman's finished parading Mordecai around the city, he runs home to have a big sulk and a big cry and be consoled by his wife and his mates. And they say something strange to him. They say, look, mate, what do you expect to happen? Of course you're going to lose if you take on the Jews. Verse 12, afterward, Mordecai returned to the king's gate, but Haman rushed home with his head covered in grief and told Zeresh, his wife, and all his friends everything that had happened to him. His advisors and his wife Zeresh said to him, since Mordecai, before whom your downfall has started, is of Jewish origin, you cannot stand against him. You will surely come to ruin. While they were still talking to him, the king's eunuchs arrived and hurried Haman away to the banquet Esther had prepared. Now, this is a really strange thing to say. Why would they think this about the Jews? Maybe this is another thing that hints to the anti-Semitism that's in the background to the book of Esther. Remember how, right back in the beginning, Mordecai told Esther to hide her ethnicity when she was taken into the harem. And also, we've got Haman. He discovers that Mordecai's a Jew, and he decides, look, I'm not just going to kill Mordecai. I'm going to wipe out all the Jews. There's this background of anti-Semitism in the book. maybe behind the anti-Semitism is that the Jewish exiles never really fitted into Babylonian or Persian culture. Even though they had been seeking the peace and prosperity of the city, like God had said through Jeremiah, they had stuck out like a sore thumb. Maybe because of the Old Testament laws and their idolless worship of Yahweh, the Jews had always been distinct and different in Persian and Babylonian society. And possibly, as they stood out as different, possibly there was this sort of awe or maybe even superstition surrounding them. How on earth did these guys manage to maintain their religious and their national and their ethnic identity? They've kept worshipping their God, Yahweh, alone, even though they've been through so much, nation after nation attacking them. Whatever the reason, this is a strange thing that they have had to say. And it's an ominous note for Haman. Everything is coming undone for Haman. And when he arrives at the banquet, which only a few hours ago he thought would be the absolute highlight of his life, I reckon he is just wrecked. He's just, oh, heck. But things are only going to get worse for him. Remember, Haman and Xerxes at this point, they have no idea that Esther is a Jew, let alone that she is Mordecai's cousin. We know this. They have no idea. But they're about to find out. And when Xerxes asks Esther again what her real agenda is, she comes out with it. Someone is attempting to kill me and my people. So pick up the story at chapter 7, verse 5. Esther, chapter 7, verse 5. King Xerxes asked Queen Esther, "Who is he? Where is he, the man who has dared to do such a thing, to attempt to kill you and your people?" Esther said, "An adversary and enemy, this vile Haman." Then Haman was terrified before the king and queen. The king got up in a rage, left his wine, and went out into the palace garden. But Haman, realizing that the king had already decided his fate, stayed behind to beg Queen Esther for his life. This has not been Haman's day. He's gone from walking with his head in the clouds to pleading for his life. Haman is begging Esther for mercy. In his desperation, it sounds like he grabs hold of her, and at that very moment, another coincidence, the king walks in and poetic justice is done. Verse 8, just as the king returned from the palace garden to the banquet hall, Haman was falling on the couch where Esther was reclining. The king exclaimed, "Will he even molest the queen while she is with me in the house?" As soon as the word left the king's mouth, they covered Haman's face. Then Harbona, one of the eunuchs attending the king, said, "Hey, a pole reaching to a height of 50 cubits, 23 meters, stands by Haman's house. He had it set up for Mordecai, who spoke up to help the king." The king said, "Impale him on it." So they impaled Haman on the pole he had set up for Mordecai. Then the king's fury subsided. Pretty graphic picture. As we read it, we're cheering, yeah! But you're also half repulsed. This is a violent story, but it has a beauty in its ironic, poetic, sweet, swift justice. You can't help but go, yeah, you get Haman, you kill Haman. And even though God is in the shadows, you can't help but think that all these coincidences, they're not coincidences, but God working through the normal means of people and what we would call coincidences. This is an example of the kind of justice that we dream of when we're cut off on the freeway. It is just swift and sweet. But that's just the beginning of the problem for us. Because we see this justice brought here, brought about swiftly, but we go, look, that's so rarely how things go for us. I mean, we've got lots of problems with justice. People get away with it, don't they? Is God really on about justice? And once you start asking this question, when you think about how people get away with things, how can God really be on about justice? You realize that with Haman, what initially feels like justice, it's not quite as just as we'd like. Yes, Haman is executed. And yes, he's even executed on the very pole that he set up for Mordecai, but Haman's guilt isn't just that he planned to unjustly execute Mordecai. Haman is guilty of genocide, or at least planning genocide, of crimes against humanity. Is his lone death, is his single death, is it really enough to pay for the whole race that he planned to wipe out? Another problem of justice is the punishment can never fit the crime. I remember when Jayant Patel, the guy who was called Dr. Death, you might remember him if you're not too young. He was up at Bundaberg. He was accused of extreme malpractice and negligence as a surgeon that led to around 87 people dying. When he was found guilty of unlawful killing, I remember that the families of the victims, they said in the kind of post-courtroom interviews, things like, jail is not enough. Even the death penalty would not be enough for this man. It's a fair enough objection that they were raising. If he really had caused 87 people to die, what could possibly be just? What could possibly be fair in that situation? 87 families are without fathers, mothers, grandparents, children. How on earth can we ever bring justice in that situation? Another difficulty is, although Haman is a pathological, egotistic, racist, evil man, Mordecai isn't innocent. My guess is that in the Persian culture, it was a fair enough thing to ask someone to honour the king's 2IC. And so, by not bowing down, Mordecai was, in a small way, rebelling against the king. The problem of our deep desire for justice is that when we get real with ourselves, we know that we aren't innocent either. I deserve justice, but what I want is mercy. Even in the little things, like the outrage we feel when someone cuts us off on the road, I know I'm not a perfect driver. I know I've merged without thinking, absent-mindedly driven through red lights. More deeply, often the things that make us the most angry when someone does the wrong thing against us, the reason we get so angry is that we see ourselves. I get quite frustrated when my kids don't listen to me, but then I realize that so often I don't listen to them, and I hate it when I don't listen to them, and that's probably what drives my anger when they don't listen to me. The problem of justice, it's not just that so often we see people get away scot-free. It's not just that when people are caught that the punishment not only doesn't but cannot fit the crime. But another problem is that it's also me. I'm far from perfect. But the good news that God gives us is found in the cross and the resurrection. The cross, the resurrection is God's unambiguous answer to the problems of justice. It meets the problem of me and my guilt, that I deserve to face justice, but I know that I can't face it and stand. As Psalm 130 asks, if you, Lord, kept a record of sins, Lord, who could stand? The problem of wanting justice is it leaves no hope for you and me. What we deserve is God's justice. What we desperately need is God's mercy. If God was just to ignore our sins, that would be incredibly unfair. How horrible would the story of Esther be if Haman's sin was ignored? If Mordecai just ended up on that pole whilst Haman got more and more glory and honour and power? We hate injustice. What we desperately need mercy. But how can God be merciful without also being unjust? Well, Paul answers this exact question in Romans chapter 3 and explains that the way that God can be both merciful and just is because Jesus takes upon himself the just punishment that we deserve so that God can show mercy. So Romans 3:25, God presented Christ as a sacrifice of atonement through the shedding of his blood to be received by faith. He did this to demonstrate his righteousness, his justice, because in his forbearance he had left the sins committed beforehand unpunished. He did it to demonstrate his righteousness at the present time so as to be just, so as to do the right thing, and the one who justifies, who says that sinners are right before him for those who have faith in Jesus. The cross answers our need for mercy and justice, as Christ, because of his love, receives the punishment that our sins deserve so that we can stand before God. But this isn't the full story of God's justice, because as verse 26 says, although this offer is open for everyone, only those who trust in Jesus find a merciful God. So the cross and resurrection also do answer the other two problems we have with justice. The problem of those who seem to get away with it scot-free, those who just miss out on seeing justice at all in this life, and those who are caught and are punished by the police and the courts, but whose punishment barely seems to bring justice. The resurrection is proof, God's proof, that no one will escape justice. Acts 17:31, for God has set a day when he will judge the world with justice by the man he has appointed. He has given proof of this to everyone by raising him from the dead. The resurrection of Jesus shows this in two ways. It shows God's justice in two ways. Firstly, it shows that Jesus is the judge. Jesus is God's eternal king. He's been given all of God's authority, a king from David's line who is perfectly just. There is no corruption in him. He is God's eternal king. Jesus has been raised to life. Death can never stop him or his rule of justice. And the resurrection of Jesus also means that death is not the end. We think that death puts the full stop on justice. Once someone has died, no court can put them on trial, no jail can lock them up. Even though Haman planned the death of a whole race, the most justice he could face was one execution. But because Jesus has been raised to life, death is not the end. Those who think they've managed to evade justice their whole life will have to stand before Jesus. Those who have faced some imperfect form of justice during their life, we know wasn't able to bring justice, they will have to stand before Jesus. And Jesus will judge them justly. We want justice, but we know that we rarely see it. But God is a God of justice. And in the gospel, in Jesus' death and resurrection, God promises justice and mercy. So let's pray and praise God for his justice. Let's pray.